Pale-Faced Targ by Kenna Finway. Appendix: The Price of a Life. The sun slipped lower, sinking slowly behind the village. The heat was still unbearable, but as he sat huddled against the pillory post, Thorongil began to shiver. His thoughts were muddled, and he could scarcely feel the pain of his burns. Fever was setting in. How many hours had he languished here, helpless beneath the merciless sun? How many hours since he had taken the old man's water? How much more could his body endure? He had only to wait for sunset. The man in the fine russet robes had decreed that he would sit here until nightfall, overriding the more temperate sentence of his blue-clad countrymen, who advocated that he sit until noon. The other men, the rich men, filled with hatred of those of the race of Numenor, had quickly taken their lead from their well-spoken compatriot. Evening to nightfall. Almost a whole day trussed up like an animal, wilting beneath the cruel desert sun. His heart grew cold within him. For one less resilient, such a punishment might have been a death sentence. Without the dipper full of water and the sluicing that the boys had given him, the sun might have claimed even his life. He forced his eyes open against the swelling tissues of his face and studied his lengthening shadow. An hour, maybe less. He could cling to hope a little longer. This sun, this heartless southern sun, how could he reconcile the loving sun that brought prosperity and sweet summer days to his home in the north with this fiery demon that robbed him of breath and offered only pain and misery? He knew it must be the same sun, for he had walked from Ithilien through Harandor and into these distant lands beneath its ever-mounting glare, and yet his bewildered mind could not accept the sameness. In this land they worshipped the sun in awe and terror. The god of death, the people called her. Now he understood why. Footsteps. His pulse quickened. It was not yet sundown. They were not coming to free him. What fresh torment did they have in store? He dared not hope that it might be the kind old man, returning with water. He braced himself, attempting to rally his wits in anticipation of further mistreatment. Someone seized the bonds about his wrists and began to fumble with them. Thorongil once more forced his sore eyes open, and a thrill of misery washed over him. It was the man in russet robes, his chiseled face unreadable, and his eyes cold with loathing and disdain. He was untying the bonds, not cutting them, such as an Elda or a Dunedain or even an orc would have, but carefully working the knots free. Of course, Thorongil thought. It was logical. Rope was made from plant fiber, and such plants needed water to grow. The intrinsic value of rope, like the intrinsic value of anything that needed water in its growth or making, was higher here where water was scarce. Perfectly good lengths of rope could not be wasted, even if it meant close contact with a reviled enemy. He wondered how many others had been bound with the cords now twisted about his limbs. Petty criminals, adulterers, maudlin drunks. Perhaps there had even been others like him, guilty of no crime but the pallor of their skin. Yet Thorongil knew that his own case was not so simple. Though to the eyes of the villagers he was nothing more than a begging Tark, in truth he was something else entirely. He was not a blameless innocent persecuted for his appearance. He was a war criminal, though they knew it not. He had heard people speak, in the towns and villages far behind, of the sacking of Umbar. Many of the folk of this region had gravitated there, in search of a better life in the green spaces by the sea. Many had found menial work in the shipyards or upon the vessels of the corsairs, unskilled laborers, oarsmen, household servants. Many had been slain in the raiding of the havens. Many more had died in the resulting fires. Many folk in this land had lost friends or loved ones to the pale faces in an assault that he had proposed and coordinated and led. He had not thought of the innocent when he planned his venture. It had not occurred to him that there might be blameless folk dwelling in a fastness of the enemy. Simple, unhappy folk, who had fled from a land oppressed by Sauron's minions, only to find another place equally under the influence of the Eye. He understood now their desperation, their fear, and their pain. This was a land enslaved by darkness, and there were good people who dwelt here, groaning beneath the yoke of the shadow. The man released the last knot, and Thorongil's hands were free. He tried to wiggle his bloated fingers, and they began to tingle painfully as blood returned. The man in the russet robes was behind him now, working upon the cord that bound his feet. Alarmed by the knowledge that there was an enemy at his back, Thorongil tried to focus his attention on his hands, on rubbing his sore wrists. He swiftly stopped as the skin began to peel away beneath his clumsy fingers. He stared in horror as pale ichor oozed from the denuded flesh. Panic gripped him. He was covered in such burns. How would he be able to don his garments? How would he be able to move, to walk? They would not tolerate his presence much longer. How would he escape this place? The last rope was withdrawn. The rich man strode away, back into the village. Thorongil remained, kneeling next to the pillory, and trying to master himself. He was friendless and alone, all but naked in the gathering night, shivering with fever and desperate for water. His chest heaved violently, and he had to force himself to breathe. He had to calm himself. He had to think rationally. Rational thought was impossible. His head was pounding mercilessly, and the terrible, searing anguish in his throat blotted out all other concerns. He needed water. A cracking sob broke free from his fissured lips. Did they not understand that he needed water? There was a well in the village square. There was a well. He had seen it yestereve when he had come to this unhappy place. He had longed to draw water even then, cool, renewing water to bathe the dust from his face and banish the sands from his mouth. But his hunger had been more overpowering than his thirst, and he had tried to obtain food first. He hated himself for that weakness now. All this had happened because he had lacked the fortitude to bear for yet another day the gnawing of an empty belly. Now he did not know if he would ever eat again. All that he wanted was water, clean, cold, life-giving water. Surely they could not deny him that. They did not wish to kill him, only to debase him and to make an example of him. Had they wanted to slay him, they would have done so already. Denying him water now would be nothing less than a decree of death, and that was not what they wanted, was it? Surely they would allow him to drink, if only he could reach the well. If only he could reach the well. He tried to stand, managing to lift one sun-scorched leg and to set his foot upon the ground, but as soon as he attempted to put pressure upon it, he gasped in agony. The soles of his feet were burned, red and glossy from long exposure to the unyielding light. His whole body quivered with horror. He could not walk. Even if he could find the strength, he could not walk. His head was swimming now, and black stars occluded his vision. He needed water, and he could not walk. Therefore he must crawl. Slowly, painfully, he eased himself onto hands and knees. His shins were not badly burned, for he had been sitting upon them for most of the day. Still, the stinging sand rasped against his dry skin as he dragged himself down the path that led past the house of the merciful old man. His arms quaked, and his hands trembled as he pulled his body forward, ranga by ranga, into the village. At the sunset hour, there were few folk about. It had been at this hour that he had come to the village yesterday. Was it only yesterday? Hoping for a little food, and an obliging wall against which he might set his back for the night, and for water, blessed water, to slake his thirst after long days of careful rationing in the desert. Most of the villagers were inside, eating their humble evening meal. There were few to see him, crawling through the dust like a wretched animal. Even had the streets been lined with onlookers, he would have been past caring. All that he cared for was to reach the well. He did not know how he would have the strength to stand, nor how his shaking arms could draw the water, but he knew that he had to reach the well. It was so near now. 20 feet. 15. 10. He looked up with the last shreds of hope, and felt them shrivel within him. The man in the russet robes was standing between him and the ring of stones. His arms were crossed over his chest, and his dark eyes were fixed upon the tark and the dirt. Thorongil's arms gave way, and he fell upon his stomach, grunting in pain as his blistered skin struck the ground. He tried to push himself up, but his hands could not hold his weight. He planted his forearms firmly against the earth and managed, somehow, to raise his head again. He stared up at the man, a desperate plea in his eyes. Slowly, inexorably, the merchant shook his head from side to side. Thorongil would have wept had he any water for tears. How could they deny him this? Whatever he had done, however they had suffered, how could they deny him a mouthful of water? He knew the answer. He was less than human to them, his suffering easy to dismiss because his pale face branded him an enemy, an outsider, a Tark. That the same brutal treatment might well have met a man of Harad in a small wayside town in Gondor filled him with sickening shame. The hard-won determination that he would live, would survive to leave this hated wasteland far behind, began to slip away. Without water, there was no hope. Without water, there was only despair and slow, agonizing death. He cast about desperately, lest there might be some friendly face in this hostile country after all. There was no one. He was utterly alone. He paused. There, near the pillars where beasts of burden were bound while travelers drank, stood a stone trough. The ground about it had been pawed by many hooves and soiled by many animals. He could not see whether there was water in the trough, but his fevered eyes thought they could glimpse a reflection upon the far side of the gutter, the last light of the day glancing off of fluid. He glanced up at his tormentor, but the rich man stood, impassive, an inexorable barrier between Thorongil and the blessed relief of the well. If he saw what the pale face intended, he gave no sign. Not knowing whether he would be denied even this, Thorongil forced his ravaged body to move. Minutes crawled by like hours, and his strength was failing him, but at last, he dragged himself over the last inches of filthy earth, and his fingers touched the hot stone side of the trough. His hand crept up the side, as if the rest of his body could move no further without some promise of relief. Over the edge he reached, and felt only empty air. He pushed with one foot against the earth, drawing his body up so that his face was pressed against the stone. Further sank his arm. Nothing. Nothing. Then he felt it with the very tip of his longest finger, a surface as smooth and impenetrable as glass. It was hot and hard, and he choked on his despair, but as he tried to withdraw, he pressed unwittingly against it, and it gave way beneath his fingertips. Water. The sound that tore from Thorongil's bleeding lips was harsh and inhuman. Caring nothing for dignity, he scrabbled with his legs, and in a desperate surge of strength that he did not know he still possessed, he hauled himself up and lowered head and shoulders into the trough. His fingers clawed wretchedly at the water, trying to bring it to his lips. He succeeded only in splashing his face, and so he lowered himself further. Mouth and nose sank into the fluid, and he sucked at the water like a horse, like a dog. It was hot and stagnant, fouled by the spittle of donkey and ox. But it was water. Water! Oh, blessed water! He drank, gulping greedily at the unpleasant fluid, until at last he was obliged to raise his head and draw in a ragged breath. For an instant there was hallowed relief, as if the healing hands of Este herself had laved his brow and poured the mead of Valinor down his tortured throat. Then a dreadful realization struck him. In his desperation, he had drunk too quickly. His stomach clenched, and he retched, the priceless fluid burning its way back up and spilling from his mouth. He coughed and heaved, and the edge of the trough bit painfully into his blistering chest. He slid backwards, falling with a leaden thump upon the dirty ground. Anguish enveloped him, and he knew no more. Lar. When he awoke, darkness was thick around him. He was shivering violently, his bare, wounded body ill-equipped to protect itself from the cold desert night. His thirst was a torment. His throat felt swollen closed for want of water. Yet his head was clearer than before. The chill of the evening had done something to mitigate the effects of the sun sickness. The pain of the burns was terrible, but when he tried to raise his arm, he found he was able. Some measure of strength had returned to him. Slowly, excruciatingly, he rolled onto his side and hauled himself once more over the edge of the trough. The water within was cooler now, for the night air had leached away its heat. He cupped his hand and brought a little to his lips, only a little this time, and his eyelids contracted in bliss. Though the water was sour and clouded with dust, it was all that he desired in the world. With the next handful he bathed his aching eyes. A third cleared away some of the sand that choked his nostrils. He drank the fourth, slowly and cautiously. He splashed water on his burned forearms. He dribbled it down the back of his neck, where it stung the raw, oozing flesh. He drank again. Then he tried to draw up a handful to throw upon his breast, but he gathered only sludge. The trough was empty. What he had taken for an abundance of water, however dirty, had been no more than a puddle in the bottom of the trench. He eased himself up and over the side, leaning against the stone. He was exhausted. He closed his eyes. His position seemed hopeless. He was ill and far from any aid. The three mouthfuls of water had assuaged his thirst a little, but he needed more, and soon. He had nothing with which to cover his blistered body, and he could not walk. When morning came and they discovered that he had not departed from the village, who could say what they would do to him? But he was not ready to give up. He was no invalid. He was no pampered princeling, no stranger to hardship. He was a strong man, his lean body hard with muscle beneath the peeling skin. He had walked in many lands, and served with honor the mightiest lords of men. He had taken wounds that would have felled a lesser victim, and he had survived. A few days of enforced fasting and a case of sunburn could not have robbed him of all of his strength. He was not going to die here, forgotten in the distant south. Somehow, he would marshal his energies. He would find water somewhere that was not forbidden to him. He would escape. Such bravado was all very well, but more suited to the battlefield than to a situation like this. What he needed was clarity of thought and a little practicality. There had to be something, some small thing that he might turn to his advantage. He cast his eyes heavenward toward the strange stars of this forgotten land. There was no Valacirca to inspire him, no North Star to guide him. Wilwaren could not be seen. But there was the moon, a fragile, waning sickle in the hostile sky. Its cool light brought some measure of comfort, and illuminated something on the ground near his feet. The Rongel shifted carefully, dragging his body toward the mass. He reached out warily to touch it, and his fingers closed upon coarse, grubby cloth. Swiftly he sorted through the pile, taking stock of what had been left for him. Robe, headscarf, tunic, shirt, hose and boots. They had returned his clothing. His empty water skin was there also, but though he groped around, he could not find his knife. Unarmed was as good as naked in such hostile lands, and Thorongil's stomach twisted with the first palpitations of panicked hysteria. He fought them back. At least now he could guard his body from the cold. It was the small thing for which he had been hoping a moment before. He knew that he could not dress himself properly. He was too weak, and anyhow the heavy cloth of his own garments would stick to his burns and impede the healing. Instead, he took the thin cotton robe, and with much painful maneuvering, managed to get it over his head. It settled about his waist, but the effort had tired him immensely. He slouched forward to ease the ache across his scorched back. He could not walk tonight, nor could he leave the village without replenishing his water skin. His eyes found the shadowy mass of the well. It was unguarded now. It would be such a little thing to drag himself toward it, to work the pulley, and haul up a bucket of water. Yet if he were caught, stealing water that had been forbidden him. The punishment for thieving was the same as that which he had just endured. Another day exposed to the merciless sun would kill him. He needed to find shelter. He could make no claim upon the mercy of these people. That much was certain. He had no right to such mercy, and even if he had, they would be loath to give it. He held them blameless in that, but his plight was a bitter one. Money might buy what pity could not, but he had no coin. His poor garments were worthless, and even if he had dared part with his boots, they were useless in such a climate as this, to feet unaccustomed to the confines of leather. He had nothing of value, not even his knife. Nothing of value. The Rongil's hands trembled as he groped for his coat. The laces had been torn, and it was an easy thing to wrench the garment inside out. His hands fumbled for the place where the left sleeve joined the body, clumsy fingers following the stitches, tiny ones made by an elven tailor long ago, and larger, imperfect ones where he had modified the garment himself with a sailmaker's needle. He found it, the place where a hard mass was concealed in the heavy felled seam. His nails were cracked and ragged, useless for the task at hand. Instead, he bent low and tore at the thread with his teeth. The linen fibers shredded and split, and he was able to pry the two pieces of wool apart. The article he sought came tumbling out, glinting in the moonlight as it landed in the sand. Hastily he bundled up his clothing and his boots and the useless water-skin. These he tucked into the crook of one arm. He picked up the shimmering thing, and curled his fist around it. With that hand in his knees for support, he began to crawl away from the trough, away from the well, up the path that led back to the crossroads. His progress was slow, and he halted often to draw ragged breaths and to battle the rising thirst. At each hesitation, he was forced to face what he was about to do, forced to contemplate the price of his life. Guilt like nausea washed over his body, and his blood ran cold, but it was a choice between this or death, and he knew there was no choice. He reached it at last, the one door that was less than hostile. He hated himself for this, that he would throw himself upon the one hand that had shown him kindness in this village, and cheapen mercy with a bribe. Yet here, too, he had no choice. Shame or death. He crept up the stoop and leaned against the post. With a shaking fist squeezed tight around cool metal, he knocked. The door opened more swiftly than he would have expected. The bent figure looking down upon him held an earthenware lamp that illuminated a dark, wizened face and a shock of alarmingly white hair. The old man's eyes narrowed, but there was no surprise in them. The Rongil looked up, swollen eyes squinting in the light. "Please," he rasped, forcing out the alien syllables. "Please, I need shelter. 2 days, I beg of you." The old man did not speak. He made no motion to close the door. He stood silent, looking down upon his unwanted caller. "Please," the Rongil repeated. Though he spoke the common tongue of Harad well, he knew only the rudiments of this local dialect. But his poor vocabulary was equal at least to this. "Shelter and water. 2 days. I will pay you. I will pay." He uncurled his fist, and his one treasure sparkled in the lamplight, silver and gold, and brilliant, dancing green. "My ring," he breathed, "my ring for shelter. Shelter and water, I beg you. 2 days, then I will be gone." The old man peered warily out into the night beyond the supplicant. Then he bent and plucked the ring from Tarongil's hand. The younger man flinched as a part of his soul was snatched away with it. He watched in desolation as the signet of his line was inspected carefully by the aged stranger. The twin serpents entwined, the crown of flowers, green eyes glimmering, their stones cut in Valinor before the destruction of the two trees. For 7,000 years it had passed down the line of Elros, from father unto child, from mother unto son. Countless hands had worn it since first Arfin's son tugged it from his finger, hands of lords and kings. It had travelled to the fairy seat of Morgoth, and survived the sack of Sirion, and sailed the western sea to dwell long in Numenor. It had passed from the keeping of the faithful, and with the sinking of Atalante, it had been borne to Middle-earth upon the hand of Elendil himself. Into Mordor had it travelled, to be brought out once more, and it had come home from the massacre at the gladdened fields unscathed, though all the hosts of Arnor fell. The falling line of kings had kept it, and even Arvedwy had safeguarded it from harm ere he was lost in the waters of Forachel. 15 chieftains had kept it through hardship and toil, and it had been given at last into the keeping of their descendant, by the hand of Elrond Peredo himself. All of its lofty history had been distilled down to this. He, unworthy successor of the greatest heroes of men, was casting it away for 2 paltry days of shade and succor. It was an ignominious end to a tale as long and enduring as any ever told. Yet though it was dear, it was only a thing. Though he was unworthy to bear it, it was not worth more than his life. If he kept it, and he perished, then his bloodline would perish with him. There would be no 17th chieftain to inherit the ring of Barahir, no heir of Isildur to continue the ragged lineage. If he perished here, in this distant desert, no one would ever know where he lay, nor where the ring had been lost. He closed his eyes against his anguish, and repeated his plea. 2 days, for my ring. The old man grunted softly, and tossed the piece of jewelry carelessly onto the low table by the door. He bent and took hold of Thorongil's arm, tugging insistently. With an enormous effort, the exhausted man hauled his body over the threshold. The old man closed the door, barring it swiftly, and set the lamp down with care, next to the cast-off ring. He helped his unwanted guest to drag himself across the floor, and settled him on a wooden mat in the far corner. Then, with experienced hands, he dragged the grimy robe from off the oozing body, tossing it after the bundle of abandoned garb. For a moment, overcome with the pain of his burns, the Rongil hung his head and panted desperately into his chest. The old man drew a gourd of water from a tall urn, and offered it to Thorongil. His hands were trembling too much to allow him to hold it, and some of the precious water spilled onto the packed earth of the floor. Dark hands took the vessel from him, and held it to his lips. He drank cautiously, wary of inducing further illness. The old man dipped his fingers into the water, and anointed the wanderer's fevered brow. Then he set aside the gourd, and eased Thorongil back against a ragged cushion stuffed with some kind of dry grass. Suddenly the last vestiges of strength ebbed from his limbs. As utter enervation surged up to claim him, Thorongil was dimly aware that his reluctant host had snuffed out the light. Lar. All the next day, while Thorongil shook with fever and struggled to stifle sobs of agony, the old man kept his distance. He crept near at times to help the stranger drink a little, but otherwise he sat on the far side of the room, watching with dark and inscrutable eyes while his hands wove his baskets. He made no move to offer comfort, but neither did he show any signs of open hostility. In his brief moments of lucidity, the Rongil could not fault his host's behavior. After all, that was their contract, water and shelter, in exchange for the ring. When night fell and the little hut grew cool, the Rongil's shivering ebbed. The fever, he suspected, had broken, though the mat beneath him clung painfully to the weeping skin of his arms and his back. Desert nights were long, and the old man was sitting by the light of the lamp, still working noiselessly with the reeds. Thorongil lay still for a time, drifting in and out of consciousness, but at last he rolled onto his side, and slowly, painfully, raised himself up. He sat upon the mat, perspiration dripping into his eyes. Wordlessly, the old man laid aside his work and rose, leaning heavily upon his staff. He hobbled across the small room, and held out the gourd of water. This time Thorongil's hands trembled less violently, and he managed to bring it to his own lips. With a curt nod of approval, the old man turned away, moving toward his fire beneath a hole in the mud roof. There was a cooking pot hanging over the embers, though Thorongil could smell nothing from it. The old man took another gourd, and filled it from the pot. He returned to his guest and offered the dish. It was a colorless mush made of ground meal and pale beans. No spoon was offered, and so Thorongil dipped 2 fingers into the mixture, drawing up a little toward his mouth, and licking it from his hand. It was tasteless and unsalted, as bland as the desert sands, yet it was sustenance, and he had made no provision in their agreement for food. This was a kindness, not a mercenary act. He looked up. "Thank you," he said softly. The old man shrugged his shoulders and shuffled back to the fire, helping himself to the poor supper. Each ate in silence, but though he had not tasted food in many days, Thorongil found himself unable to finish the frugal helping of mush. Ashamed of his ingratitude, he laid aside the gourd. The old man came to collect it, steadying the contents. He clicked his tongue in the back of his throat and tipped a little water into the dish. Then he covered it with a small scrap of cloth and returned it to Thorongil's side. "Perhaps later," he said simply. Then he picked up his stick and a small pot and left the hut. Thorongil's eyes strayed to the low table where the ring of Barahir still lay, forgotten. Again he felt a twinge of remorse. He had been entrusted with an ancient heirloom, and not an heirloom of his house alone. It was as much the birthright of his foster father as it was of himself. He never asked how this treasure of the line of Luthien had come to Elros rather than Elrond, but at this moment it seemed as if he was casting away something that did not belong to him. Yet he knew in his heart that Elrond would understand. Though it was difficult to think of such things after so many years away from home, Master Elrond loved him, and had labored so carefully to guard him from death. To choose survival over a silver bauble was the wise decision, and he knew that his foster father would forgive him. That made the sacrifice no easier to bear. For nearly 30 years he had borne it, openly upon his finger, or secretly on a chain about his neck, or tucked carefully into a pouch, or, most lately, concealed in the very fabric of his tunic. Without it he felt a nakedness that had nothing to do with his disgraceful state of undress. He stared at it for a time. It was only a thing, he told himself. A trinket, a trifle. Though he had lost it, it had bought him his life. Weary beyond the telling, Thorongil eased himself back down onto the mat. He was asleep even before the old man returned with fresh water. Lar. He slept through much of the next day, but when he awoke even briefly, he drank. His blisters still pained him, and the skin where the burns were not so severe was peeling away, and the skin where the burns were not so severe was peeling away like the scales of a snake. He was hot and uncomfortable, and he itched dreadfully, but he knew that the peril was passing. He ate the remainder of his mush, and the old man brought him water again and again. Night fell at last, and the 2 days were ended. Thorongil carefully drew on his hose, though the points had been snapped in his violent undressing 3 nights past. He folded the tops down carefully about his knees. It was painful to haul his boots over his sore ankles and calves, but the soles of his feet were healed to the degree that they seared with itch and not with pain. He had checked them carefully for fissures or blisters and found nothing. They were fit to be used. He struggled into the robe and wrapped his head with care, draping the scarf carefully so that only his eyes could be seen. His remaining clothes he knotted together in his coat, and he filled his water skin from the old man's urn. There were no further preparations to make, for he had no other possessions now. He was utterly destitute, bereft of his only belonging of any worth, but at least he was alive. The old man watched him from his place in the corner. When Thorongil was at last on his feet, he bowed to his host. "Thank you," he said, taking care with the pronunciation. "You are very kind." The old man stood up and took a bundle of cloth from one of his baskets. He held it out, and Thorongil took it, puzzled. "Hard bread and a little cheese," the old man explained. "You will have a hungry road. My people do not trust the pale faces. Keep the cloth over your mouth. Do not be a fool." He hefted up an old, brittle skin filled with water. "One sack is not enough," he added. Thorongil nodded unsteadily, his throat tightening at this unexpected kindness. He eased the strap of the skin over his free shoulder, grating his teeth a little as it rubbed upon his raw flesh. He tucked the bundle in amidst his clothes. "Once more, I thank you," he said. "I will not forget." The old man grunted and opened the door. The darkness without was oppressive, but Thorongil welcomed it. Weakened though he was, he knew that he could put many miles between himself and this place before the dawn. He stepped out into the night, looking back at his savior. He pulled the cloth from his mouth and smiled with sore lips. "Thank you," he repeated. Then he covered his pale face again and turned to go. "Wait!" The old man came hobbling after him, staff thumping against the sand. He seized Thorongil's hand and pressed something hard and smooth into his palm. "It is of no use to me. No man should have to trade his only treasure for his life," the old man said, and the inscrutable black eyes were suddenly gentle. "Go, and remember we do not all hate without cause." Thorongil looked down as the dark hand withdrew. There, settled into the cup of his hand, was the ring of Barahir. For a moment he was stunned, incapable of breath or motion. Then he turned, too late. "Wait!" he cried as the door slipped closed. There was a soft thud as it was barred. He stood there, open-mouthed with wonder, for a long moment. Unable to look at the ring, he closed his fist around it, unshed tears stinging in his eyes. He turned his back upon the old man's door and took the first unsteady steps away from the village. His mind struggled to process what had just occurred as the heat of his hand leached into the silver in his palm. He had much to learn, it seemed, about these folk who dwelt beneath alien skies, enslaved from afar by the shadow. As much as he yearned for the green hills of home, and as much as he dreaded the next fiery sunrise, he knew his work here was not yet complete. He gathered his courage, fighting for mastery over his apprehension and over the pain already prickling up and down his blistered back. He could not submit to either. At the crossroads, he turned south. Metta. One who cannot cast away a treasure at need is in fetters. Aragorn, Flotsam and Jetsam, The Two Towers, J.R.R. Tolkien.